Stopwatch is counting, and that means hello there and welcome to the first edition of 2005 at our little show called Blind Like Me. I'm radio guy Phil Parr, and as most of you know, our thrust here is to interview, as I was saying, people who are successfully handling blindness, who are able to deal, who are able to operate in the world, who are not sitting around crying because they're blind or bitching about it or fussing, who are going on with life. We've done 65 of these, and number 65 will be this gentleman named Eric Weinmayer. Sir, how are you?
I'm doing well.
And what part of the country are you in?
I'm in Golden, Colorado. That's when I'm home.
Golden, Colorado, when you're home, which isn't much, is it?
It isn't all that much. I travel quite a bit.
Yeah.
Climbing, speaking, sometimes doing book tours, things like that. So
yeah.
It's good to be home when I am.
Good to be home when you are. What, I know there must be another, people say, what do you do? I'm a mountain climber. There must be a term. What is the term for what you do?
It's a really hard thing to... You know, to sum up, you know, I could say I'm a professional mountain climber, but that's really not like being a professional football player where people are throwing millions of dollars at you. You know, I do have some sponsors. They sponsor either climbs or they sponsor me as an athlete to go and do things, or they sponsor me to go and speak to groups. So, you know, there is sponsorships and so forth to be had, but it's not really like I'm on some kind of professional climbing team.
Yeah, but to come up with a name like spelunking or any, you know,
no, nothing like that. Professional mountain climber, but mountain climber, mountain climbing consists of all sorts of different things, and it's so you're right. It is kind of vague. I mean, mountain climbing could be hiking up a slope. It could be actually skiing because that's part of mountaineering. It could be rock climbing, climbing vertical rocks. It could be climbing frozen waterfalls or glacier ice, you know, ice that's been formed by glaciers.
Yeah.
So it encompasses a whole bunch of things, and some people specialize, some people try to do it all.
Yeah, because they said that you were out, I think when I talked to your assistant the other day, he said you were out ice climbing. And
exactly, and in Ouray, Colorado, southwest tip of Colorado, there's a beautiful... a narrow valley called Ouray, and in that is a box canyon, and the water pours down the rock, kind of seeps down the rock, and it freezes over time. So there are these huge ice pillars and ice walls and ice flows, and so one of the sports is of mountaineering is to climb those with your ice tools. You have two heavy metal ice tools in your hands and crampons on your boots, and Gore-Tex over your body so that, you know, you're not, when the water's kind of dripping down the ice, you're not getting soaked. And you actually climb that. And the way I climb as a blind person climbing ice, people told me, you know, you swing. They said it's not like rock climbing. You can't just feel your way up the ice. You've got these big, sharp, heavy metal tools in your hands. If you swing in the wrong spot, you'll knock a giant-sized chunk of ice down. It'll come down and crush you, you know, something the size of a refrigerator.
Yeah.
Or it'll crush your partner. And I had, you know, the consistent thing that I've had in my life are good friends who are willing to kind of defy the convention and say, hey, let's go out and see if it's possible. And
yeah.
And so we went out, and I started ice climbing, and I learned that I could feel through the tips of my tools, sort of like they were extensions of my hands. I could actually feel through the tips and feel those little divots, those little weak spots in the ice. where I thought I'd want to swing. And before I swing hard, I'll tap the ice a little bit, and I'll listen for the sound, and I'll feel the vibration through the ice. And that's the way I know how to swing. So, normally, a sighted person looks at healthy blue ice versus the rotten white ice. You know, they can actually see the places to swing, but I have to feel it and hear it. So
this is this tool is an actual cane for ice climbers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what it is. Two kind of metal, very sharp canes.
Because my friend,
and actually canes on your feet too, because you have front points, these little points, very sharp points that stick out of your boots, out of each boot. So I can actually feel with my front points of my metal spikes, you know. But that's a little harder to feel through your feet. I have to say that's a little more challenging.
Sure, it would be. Now, of course, the most famous thing you've done is climb Mount Everest, and yes, I want to talk about that. But I also want to get back to, if you mind, ask how what age you are.
I'm 36 now.
36 now. So compared to me, just a child.
Knees and elbows are starting to get a little rough. I think that's because of a lot of years of abuse. But that's the way it is.
Now, how did you? Were you born without sight, or how did you lose your sight?
I was born with this rare eye disease called retinaschisis. It's a really rare one. It kind of unravels your retinas because there's high pressure in your eyes, and it makes your retina sort of split away and it unravel a little bit. And you know, so I was born legally blind, although that's obviously a legal term. I could see well enough to ride a bike and to walk around and to run around with my friends and live a pretty adventurous childhood in Connecticut. And then about sixth grade, I started noticing sight loss. It was, you know, I'd wake up every week to a different vision, you know, and by the time I was a freshman in high school, that summer between my eighth and ninth grade year, I went totally blind. And I remember it was a, you know, pretty scary thing because I went from being able to walk around to suddenly not being able to see well enough to even take a step. I mean, it was pretty scary, you know, for the first little bit.
So you were about 14, I guess,
exactly.
About 14 years old.
Yeah.
And up until then, life had been, I hate to use the term normal, but life had just been little Eric growing up, right?
It had been, for the most part, if I tried to ignore, you know, some of the things that I knew were going to happen, when I was like 5 years old, you know, after a round, you know, dozens and dozens of eye doctor visits around the country, they finally diagnosed me and they said that there's no cure to this disease and that I would be blind by 13 years old. So I knew that that was sort of a prediction. Yeah. So I did kind of live those years kind of with this fear over me, and I didn't know exactly what blindness was because, I mean, I was born with the sight I had and it was all I knew, but I did kind of feel like there was something looming over me. And, I also did have that flux, you know, that change of vision constantly. So there wasn't an amazing amount of stability in my life, even as a young kid, even though I did my best to ignore it and just kind of persist through.
You said that they told you at the time that there wasn't a cure. Is there a cure now?
No, there's still no cure. You know, the closest they're getting actually, well, you know, now with gene therapy, I've heard Foundation Fighting Blindness is doing a lot of work in this area, and they're, they're actually able to take mice that have retinaschisis, and they're able to prevent the disease from happening by splicing some genes into the mix that prevents the disease from ever happening at all. But you know, once it's happened, once the damage is done, you know, they're very, very far from a cure. Yeah. In fact, I think cures will probably be more technological than they will be biological.
Well, we've often discussed here, it is my firm belief we're looking at the last generation of blind people, but then that's neither here nor there. Well, that's another program. That's a panel discussion. So 14, you find yourself totally blind. What did they decide to do with you or about you?
Well, my parents wanted me to go to be mainstreamed. They had a belief, right or wrong, that, you know, that I was going to have to live in the world, so I needed to function in the world.
They were right.
I think they were right.
Oh, they were.
And
yes.
So socially, I was right hanging in there with friends and so forth and trying to compete. What was light in my education was the Braille training. I had a great Braille teacher, but one was I didn't see myself at first as a blind person, so I didn't, it was like I was looking through a rearview mirror into the past.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really want to learn Braille because that's what blind people did, and I was too cool to be blind or something, I look back and see how ridiculous that is and
yeah, you were
how
14.
Much time I wasted, but in middle school or early high school years, you're just so lost, And so I didn't work on Braille as well as I should have, and probably didn't get enough Braille instruction.
You were in denial, and I think
I was in denial, exactly.
That's normal. I mean, there would be something wrong with you if you hadn't.
I was a little bit of a stubborn kid. But people said you have to use a cane, and I knew I had to use a cane, but I would use it wrong, and then one day I was walking down a dock, and I wasn't using my cane properly, and it was right before I was losing the last little bits of vision, and I had this weird thing where I saw like kind of double, I saw like the reflection of things, and I almost couldn't separate them, and I thought the dock went one way, and it didn't. It was an illusion, and I stepped off the dock, and I did a flip in the air, and I landed on my back on the deck of a boat that happened to be parked there, and so I dropped like 8 feet and landed on my back on the boat, and I thought, oh, my God, you almost killed yourself, and, you better start learning to function, or you're going to kill yourself. It doesn't matter what your brain's saying, you got to survive. So
yeah.
I started learning how to use a cane.
But of course, at 14, that didn't hurt you a bit, that falling 8 feet.
It didn't, but I was
But he's changing.
I didn't know how to get back up on the dock, so I shimmied up this, this wooden beam that got me back up onto the dock, and so I put like hundreds of splinters all in my forearms and everything, trying to climb back up.
Because you wanted to be cool. You didn't want to admit
it. I didn't want anyone to see me laying on my back on that boat and feel sorry for me or anything.
All right. So they left you in public school, and they started some Braille training. And I guess but people probably talked about, well, maybe you ought to go get a CNI dog. You didn't do that.
My mom wanted me to get a guide dog. She always thought that would be a cool thing, And there's all this debate, what's better, a cane or a dog. And, and I think both are great, And a cane you can fold up and you don't have to feed and groom and you can have great independence with a cane. I used to cane for 2 years or more and got pretty good at it. And then my mom really wanted me to get a dog because I wrestled on my high school team. I found wrestling, and that was one of the great things. I know this may come out wrong, but I once I realized on the mat that I could actually wrestle sighted kids and I could actually throw sighted kids on their back and pin them, and I was better, stronger than a sighted kid, it kind of made me feel like I was even, like I was on a level playing ground, and that sort of sense of competition kind of brought me back and made me feel like I wasn't, everything I did, I wasn't going to be at this huge disadvantage.
You say you think that came out wrong. I've been totally blind 64 years. I think it came out just right. If you think it doesn't thrill me when my brother-in-law says, hey, Phil, if you were going to build this deer stand, how would you do it? And he can see and I can't. If you think that doesn't make me feel 10 feet tall, it does.
Yeah, it did. It felt good, And to be a part of a team and to have friends, that weren't afraid to take me and slam me on my back. They didn't baby me.
That's good.
And, but my mom wanted me to get a dog. Sadly, that year she died in a car accident, and that was a tragedy that was 100 times worse than blindness.
Oh, yeah.
And so she never saw my dog, but... that year I did apply, and I got a guide dog, my first guide dog, Wizard.
Now, obviously, when you first began to deal with blindness, ice climbing and mountain climbing was the furthest thing from your mind, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I would have never thought in a million years that I would be doing anything like that. But, you know, in a weird way, it does translate to the kind of stuff I was doing. When I was a kid, I loved adventure, you know. I loved basketball. I loved wrestling. But when I found I couldn't play basketball and things like that, I started looking for other sports, other things I could do. And, you know, so I drifted towards a group of kids that kind of, you know, a little bit were the little bit of troublemakers in the school. You know, they are the kind of kids that would run off the playground into the woods, and we'd go and find this, you know, this pond that was partly frozen over, and see who was brave enough to run across the ice, and who would be the one to climb the tallest tree, and who would be the one to find the biggest boulder in the woods and jump off of it into a pile of leaves. You know, and I found myself to be the kid that was often the kid trying to impress more than anyone else.
The blind kid that would actually leap from the 25-foot tree into the pile of leaves.
Exactly. And I had a mountain bike, you know, when I could see a little bit, and I used to race down my really steep driveway, and I built these ramps at the bottom of my driveway, a big wooden ramp where I'd fly off the ramp, and I'd go about 10 feet or even more. I'd try to see how far I could separate them, and I had another ramp that I'd land on. And so, you know, that was the days of when Evel Knievel was kind of popular.
Oh, yeah.
And when I couldn't see the ramps well enough anymore, when I lost sight and they kind of just blended in with the pavement, I thought I wouldn't be able to do that anymore. My dad actually did something really cool, which was he painted the ramps orange, like a really bright orange, so that they contrasted the pavement. And I always thought that was a great learning experience for me, because I thought, you know, he might have said just no more bike riding, but instead he kind of figured out a way for me to do it. And so I've always kind of thought about that, you know, how do you, you know, when you're faced with something that seems impossible, do you just say, oh, it's impossible, or do you, maybe there's this little secret system that you can implement that gets you around it, you know, a little alternative system that you just have to think and figure out. And to me, that's been a great sort of learning experience and journey through blindness, to kind of figure out how to make those things possible when you're not really sure how to do it.
Well, we interview blind people, we always ask them, now, when you're a kid, your parents let you run and ramble and do whatever you wanted to. And everyone, without exception, that's successful says, yeah, they didn't really worry about me. If I ran into a tree, I ran into a tree, and that was kind of my fault, and I shouldn't have done that. And if, you know, they didn't treat me any different, and that's that your daddy did.
And my dad was like that. You know, he was a Marine, and he had a real great can-do attitude. My mom was a worrier. You know, she didn't like to see me bleed, like no moms do, but the tenderness of my mom and the kind of go-gettingness of my dad was a good combination.
Sort of.
My dad kind of would sweep me out, and I'd get shattered into a million pieces, and my mom would build me up again, and then my dad would sweep me out again. So,
all right, let's take a short break, and we want to talk about, I'm sure you considered college or went to college, and we'll get into that in just a minute. More of our show with Eric Weinmayer and Blind Like Me, back in a minute.
You think on the blind side. Here's Don Patterson.
You know, as an educator of the blind and visually impaired school-age children, community college level, there's one recurring problem, and that seems to be having all the Braille materials you need for your students when you need them. It sort of harkens back to Abraham Lincoln, you know, having some of the materials all the time, or all the materials some of the time, but seems like never all of them all the time. And in browsing on the internet, I ran across an interesting article that describes how one state in particular has perhaps solved this problem. Seems that the state of Delaware, in association with several organizations, have been training inmates in their correctional institutions as Braille transcriptionists, whereby these fellows, after they're trained, are transcribing most of the Braille materials that the school-age students in Delaware need. And further research really shows that some 30 states now have started similar programs, and they've all been quite successful. The inmates in the Delaware correctional facilities have seemed to have made very good candidates for this program, and the program is quite intense. The men are subjected to at least a year's training, at the end of which they earn their certificates from the Library of Congress in Braille transcription. Now, there's three levels in this area, just Braille transcribing, and then there's the math and scientific code transcriptionist, and then there's music transcription. You know, if you stop and think about it, the benefits of this type of program are twofold. Number one, of course, is the obvious. The students have their Braille materials. But secondly, is this the possibility of employment prospects for the inmates who are trained as transcriptionists. Anyway, it sounds like a good deal to me. Key words on this subject, if you care to go read more, are blind, or prisons, and Braille embossing. Anyway, go give it a look. And that's this week's Look on the Blind Side. I'm Don Patterson.
On the Blind Side, answering questions nobody asks.
Eric Weinmayer is a guest on Blind Like Me. We've gotten him through a childhood, and an interesting childhood it was. Went blind, totally blind at about age 14 in the 8th grade, and for an 8th grader, that ain't cool. You wanted to be cool, so you wrestled, you did all kinds of things. You said, kind of got off with maybe some of the kids that were a little rebellious in school. Is that the way you'd put it?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, now, so you graduated high school in the public school there in, I guess, in the town where you live now, in Greeley, right?
Actually, I grew up in Connecticut.
Really?
And, so I was in this town called Weston, Connecticut, basically a town in the woods. And,
all right.
And so, yeah, I graduated in 87, and they even gave a little hat, one of those little square hats, to my guide dog when we graduated so that we could all be together.
All right, what did you think you might do to make yourself a living, to earn yourself a buck or two?
Well, I didn't know, you know, I had really no idea. I thought about a lot of different things, and when I graduated, well, as I was going through college, you know, I wanted to get a job, you know, just a summer part-time job, and I was going to go out to Nantucket Island. I went to Boston College. I'd always thought that Boston was a cool place. It had, you know, elevators and that were labeled in Braille, and Boston College had a technology center, you know, with all these great computers and Braille printers and everything, and it looked like a really cool place. So I went to Boston College, and then that one summer I wanted to get a job. And I had a friend from Nantucket, you know, an island off the coast of Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
He said, I'll get you a job as a clerk at a front desk of this little hotel. And, you know, and so I was psyched, you know, and I had my first summer job. And a couple weeks before I was ready to move out to Nantucket, he called me and he told me that, you know, he'd forgotten to tell them that I was blind. And when they heard that, they reneged. They didn't give me the job.
Oh, wow. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went by the hotel to try to talk them into hiring me, you know, and they had already given the job away to a 16-year-old girl. So obviously, you know, nothing wrong with a 16-year-old girl, but I guess she was apparently more qualified than I was.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because she could see.
Because she could see.
That's what made her qualified.
And, so I thought I'd try to, I had already committed to moving there, so I thought, well, maybe what's a kind of a safety, what's a job I could do? So I went and tried to get a job as a dishwasher, and I went to about 20 different restaurants on the island and asked for a job. And I remember I mean, literally, we'll go into one restaurant and they'd say, they're really nice. I mean, they really wanted to help, you could tell. And the manager said, you know, I'd love to hire you. Our kitchen's really big, though, and, you know, I think you'd lose your way and you wouldn't know where to put things away. I mean, we have all sorts of places where you put things here, and I don't think you'd be able to memorize that. And I thought, well, okay, maybe that's a valid argument. I don't know. I'll go to a kitchen that's smaller. So I went to a small restaurant with a small kitchen. And I asked for a job, and they said, well, we'd love to hire you. Again, the guy was really nice, and he said, but our kitchen's too small. You know, you'd bump into things. It's too crowded. And I thought, okay. So I went to a middle-sized restaurant with a middle-sized kitchen, and they told me that, you know, hey, our pots are too hot, you know, and you'd burn yourself. We'd love to hire you, but we think it'd be a liability.
Then there's the our insurance wouldn't cover you. If everything else fails, they'll use that one.
Yeah, and so I was a kind of a sheltered kid. I kind of grew up in this suburb, little town in the woods where everyone knew me, and I always kind of had this myth, you know, this idea that with the force of my personality or my persuasive ability, I'd be able to sell myself, to, you know, create opportunities in my life. And I realized, you know, it was a hard lesson, harsh lesson, because I never got a job that summer. I had to go home early. I ran out of money. I realized that there are real ceilings out there.
Yeah.
That, you know, that sometimes it's our obligation, I think, to just bash our heads against those ceilings until we break through. I wasn't able to do it then, but it sure did put a fire in my belly.
To offer to work as a dishwasher for a week and say, if you don't like me after a week, fire me, which would have been the thing to do, but you didn't know that then.
I didn't know that. Yeah, that would have been a good idea.
Or what were you attempting to get a degree in at Boston College?
I worked towards a degree in communications in English.
Huh?
English, I mean, it was really simple. I thought learning to speak would be important, and learning to organize my thoughts, and I also thought that learning to write would probably help me in any career. And when I graduated, I agreed with that theory, but it didn't really prepare me specifically for anything. So I tried to get a job as a teacher, and I wasn't really qualified because I didn't have a degree in teaching. So I went back, and I went to across the river to Lesley College, and I got a master's degree in middle school education. I worked as an assistant teacher during the day at a great school in Cambridge, and then I went to school at night, and I graduated with a 4.0. So I was
really,
you know, yeah, you know, so when I went out for a job that second time, you know, after my master's degree, there was nothing that people could say because I had actually taught in the classroom, and I had the best grades in my class. So, I mean, I felt like, you know, I needed to be overqualified to have a chance at getting a job. And as it turned out, I went to New York City where there was a job fair for teachers. And I applied for a job, and, I just met with people with schools all over the country that were hiring people.
A job fair for teachers.
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Okay.
So, and I got more offers than anyone in my class. I think I got two or three or four offers to go to different places.
Yeah.
I found that some people wouldn't even interview me, and some people wanted to interview me, but they didn't think they could persuade their community or their board that it was possible.
Uh-huh.
But then there were also a few standouts that just kind of thought, wow, blind teacher might be really a really great thing for our school. He's a great teacher. He's got great philosophies and so forth, but he also could maybe teach the kids a little bit extra, you know, maybe subtly about
a physical handicap, about how it is to be blind,
exactly.
How it is to meet other challenges.
I had a couple offers, and I had one in Charlotte, and one out in Phoenix. You know, I actually did have a funny interview that I went on during that fair because it was a really prestigious school in New York City that I applied to, and the headmaster interviewed me, and as I was talking, I could see he was really fidgety and nervous, and I realized later that what he was so nervous about was how he was going to get me out of that chair and down the hallway and out to the door, you know, and so when I finished the interview, I realized he wasn't even listening. He ran over and he hiked me up under my armpit, and he dragged me down the hallway and out into the taxi, and literally like put his hands under my knees and hoisted me into the taxi. I mean, he was so scared that this blind person was going to fall down the stairs or run into a wall or something. And I was thinking, how did you think I got from Boston to New York City? Do you think someone carried me and hoisted me onto the train and hoisted me out?
Or that he might actually have to hire you. God forbid that he'd have to, you know, actually.
Yeah. And I ultimately decided on this job in Phoenix.
Okay.
And that was an interesting story, too, because I interviewed with this, and I had a great couple of interviews with different people. But that didn't actually seal the job for me. What sealed the job for me was actually something I didn't know about at the time. I walked out of this job fair, and it's a crowded, huge ballroom with people, you know, just little flimsy dividers.
Everywhere.
Everyone's interviewing. And I got up with my dog, and we weaved. And they said, "Do you need help to find the hotel, the front entrance of the hotel?" And I said, "No." And I weaved through the fair, and I went out the door, and I went through the lobby, this very confusing lobby, and I found the front door with my guide dog. And as it turns out, the headmaster had been walking behind me, watching me. And she said, "Look, I mean, he sounds great, but if the guy, we need to know that he can function in a classroom. You know, if there's an emergency,
if he's going to fall over the desks and run into the blackboard.
Yeah, exactly. If there's an emergency, if there's a fire, you know, he can get the kids out of there." And she watched me weave and navigate through the lobby of the hotel and find the door independently. And she said, "Okay, he can handle it."
That's great.
And I realized if I hadn't been, you know, I could have said all the right things, but if I hadn't been able to find that door, you know, I might not have gotten the job.
So you had a well-trained guide dog that you worked well with.
Yeah.
With a cane, that would have been, you could have done it, but it would have been, in that situation, harder with a cane.
Yeah, it might have been if I, you know, but I've heard that people with canes do the same thing that I do. They kind of, when they walk into a situation, they memorize the turns and they get the spatial understanding down. They kind of get a sense of where the elevators are in the lobby or wherever they are, and they kind of start to map the area in their brain so that they can function more independently.
Sure.
And I think, you know, thank God I did that during that interview.
Okay, so you took the job in Phoenix, and did you go to Phoenix?
I went to Phoenix, and I worked there for 4 years, and I was a weekend warrior. One of the subs at the school, substitutes, was a guy named Sam, and he was a rock climber, and I had, in high school, because, you know, I wasn't able to participate in ball sports, you know, basketball and football and all the things they were doing in gym class. My dad started looking for a recreational program, and so once a month he would drive me out to the Carroll Center for the Blind in Massachusetts, where they would pick us up and then they would drive us out to, you know, to the Charles to go sailing or to go horseback riding or even skiing or ropes courses or tandem biking.
Uh-huh.
And one weekend they took us rock climbing, and I loved it. I felt, you know, like it was such an experience where I absorbed the outdoors, you know, walking down this trail and then finding this vertical rock face. It was crazy to think about having your body stick to that rock face somehow and then actually, you know, not being able to see the holds, but actually doing a pull-up and scanning my hand across the face and finding the holds with my hands and then mapping the rock with my brain, trying to figure out how to get from point A to point B to point C just with my hands and feet and my brain. It was so engaging. You know, I didn't think about being blind. I just thought about thrashing my way up that rock face and the texture of the rocks under my hands and the patterns of the sun on the rock. And it was just like a rebirth.
See, that's funny. The way you talk about it, it's quite a tactile experience, you know?
Oh, for sure.
And I guess
it
would be.
Very tactile. And so in Phoenix, I started rock climbing a lot with this guy, Sam. And then after we had climbed together for a couple years, we were rock climbing in the desert, and he said to me, "Erica," he said, "we should try to climb something bigger." And I thought, well, what, like a 200-foot rock face? And he said, "Let's go climb Mount McKinley, which is in Alaska. It's the tallest peak in North America. It's 20,300 feet. It's a huge snowy mountain.
Yeah, it is.
And that was a kind of a big step. And I thought, well, that's, you know, first of all, this guy's crazy, I thought. And he just kept talking me into it. And I liked that. It was really cool because he had a great dream. And then I kind of was the reality guy. I kind of created a plan to enable me to get there. So it turned from a crazy idea to a real idea.
But now it wasn't just you two climbing.
He wanted to add two more guys that had experience. So he introduced me to these two other guys, this guy named Ryan and this guy named Jeff, and both those guys are still good friends.
Well, I mean, can you just go decide you want to climb this mountain and do it, or do you have
to? For sure, yeah. You got to get the equipment. So we went out to this outdoor fair in Reno, Nevada, to beg gear from manufacturers, and I hooked up with Mountain Hardware, which is still my sponsor today. They make great gear and so forth, Gore-Tex and tents and everything, and they provided us with gear. And then I went to this, and then my friend Sam, we're walking by one booth, and this is where, you know, all the manufacturers...
Wait. Did you have a guide dog with you or a cane?
I had a guide dog with me at that time.
Okay.
And so we're kind of walking through the fair, and my guide dog follows, you know, I tell him to follow, so he's following Sam. Mm-hmm. And we went by one booth to this group called Lecky, and he put this pole in my hand. He said, check this out. This could be really awesome for you in the outdoors. And it was simple. They're like ski poles, except they extend. When I can extend them like as far up to like up to my nose, I'm 6 feet tall, or I can shorten them down to like, you know, the length of my waist.
Okay.
And those were the key because I needed like kind of two canes to be able to scan and feel the terrain in front of me on those rocky trails and in that snowy terrain.
Sure.
But canes aren't strong enough. They snap. They break easily. So these two Lecky poles were like two canes in my hand, and I could lean on one while I scanned the other in front of me, and then I could lean on that one and then scan the other one in front of me.
So it's sort of this
really quick motion of scanning and leaning, and you know, I can keep up with, you know, any reasonably fast person in the mountains with those poles, and I can extend them really long when I'm going downhill, and I can shorten them when I'm going uphill.
So you four people decided. Now there had to be, of course, someone had to convince the other two that taking a blind guy along is not a liability.
Here's the thing that I found in life. It's really exciting in a way because, you know, there might be eight people if you go to a group of 10 people and you say, hey, you want to climb a mountain with a blind guy? Eight of those people might say, you're crazy, no way.
Yeah.
But two of them might say, wow, that sounds exciting. And I found that's all you got to do. You got to canvas those 10 and find the two that are believers, that are
honest. And they'll convince the rest.
Yeah, and that's always the way it's been for me. You know, I've always been able to find those one or two guys out of 10 that are the believers that say, wow, this is an exciting challenge. I'd love to be a part of that.
And not only is climbing
the kind of people that you surround yourself with.
Not only is climbing the mountain exciting, but doing it with a blind person adds an even more excitement.
Yeah. And that's what I found when I was interviewing the one out of 10. Or even maybe the one out of 100. That's what I found when I look for climbing partners, you know. People who say this is an added challenge that I think is really exciting.
All right, let's take a short break here, and then we want to talk about some more accomplishments, some more of the things you've done and what you do now. And we probably need to get into your book a little bit. We're getting a little bit short on time. Back in just a minute, Eric Weinmeier is our guest, and our show is called Blind Like Me. Hang on.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you a first-time job seeker, or maybe somebody who's had a job for a while and is thinking about looking for another job? Well, you should take a look at eSight esight.org. That's esight.org. Esight has a lot of forums where you can go and talk about questions with other job seekers and other people who have jobs, such as when and if should I disclose my blindness when I'm looking for the job, and other such kinds of topics. You can find out about the interview process and how to deal with that, and how to deal with many different questions around the whole job search process. Again, the site is www.esight.org. I would give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And until next time, this is Tim Cummings for Blind Sights saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
Love
to a
is Blind,
place, but, you know,
the audio magazine
you know
for singles.
Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com.
We're back with Eric Weinmayer, our guest on Blind Like Me. We have him climbing. You are ready now to climb. What's the name of this mountain in Alaska you're fixing to climb?
It's called Mount McKinley or
Mount
Denali,
McKinley.
And that was in 1994.
And you ultimately did that, you and your three buddies.
Yeah, we got sponsorship from the American Foundation for the Blind, and they helped us raise some money, and we went... And had success. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done up to that point. It was.
You mean getting the sponsorship or climbing the mountain?
Both.
Both.
But actually, the sponsorship I found, you know, almost helped me in a way, because being blind helped me in a way, because lots of people had climbed Mount McKinley, but no blind person
had ever,
no blind man had ever done it,
ever thought about doing it.
So in a way, yeah. So in a way, it was, you know, being a blind mountain climber. Sort of like being a Jamaican bobsledder, you know.
It's so weird
that people paid attention, and in a way, so I use that as an advantage, you know. And people said, "Wow, blind guy climbed McKinley. That's crazy enough that I think that's cool. I want to get behind that and see if it's possible."
I'm surprised the guy at the foundation, when you first said, "I'm Eric Weinmayer, and I'm a rock climber, and friends of mine and I want to climb Mount McKinley, and we'd like for you to sponsor." The wonder the guy didn't say, "Is this somebody in the front office? That's a joke." You know, but they...
Well, I had a little experience with the AFB because I had done a rock climbing commercial, public service ad for them.
Uh-huh.
And it was an ad that had a blind rock climber in it. And I was the sort of actor, you know, and we went to Joshua Tree and did this rock climbing commercial that talked about the AFB. And so they knew that I was into climbing, and so I had a little bit of credibility.
Okay.
And so when, you know, they actually passed it through all their committees and thought it would be something cool, and it was, because we were on every show under the sun, the Today Show and Kathy Lee and Regis, and, you know, so we got tons of publicity for them. And so it turned out to be a good investment.
Sure, and they realized, they saw that coming. They saw that it would be.
And we had success. We summited June 27th. On Helen Keller's birthday. We had no idea. We learned that later.
That's amazing in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's wild.
And it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. In fact, I remember actually, you know, literally breaking down into tears sometimes in my tent, just thinking, there's no way I can get out of my tent and do this again tomorrow. It's so hard.
Yeah. But you did.
But I did.
But you did.
Every day I wake up and I do it again and carry these massive packs. You know, you got a 60-pound pack and you're pulling a 50-pound sled and you're crossing fields of crevasses, which are these deep slots in the glacier with thin little snow bridges that might just be 2 feet across that you're kind of zigzagging across, and you're gasping for air in high altitude, and it's freezing cold. I mean, so cold that, you know, you're just nervous all the time about getting frostbite and so forth. And after we summited, it was such an amazing experience because I got down and I lay in the snow for a while, and I just thought, there's no way you're cut out for this lifestyle. But yet at the same time, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I was so hooked, you know, so hooked on the adventure of doing this, of being out there in a place that, you know, blind person just wasn't supposed to be.
Well, of course, the other guys were having as much physical exertion as you were. So
my three friends were more tired than me on the summit. They were
really
wasted. One guy dropped to his knees. He was so tired on the summit. I realized that, you know, we're all in the same boat.
But the thrill of being on the summit must be great enough to want to get there, you wouldn't do
also,
it.
Also, it's just, you know, mountain climbing, the summit's like the symbol, you know, that you're as high as you can possibly get, that there's nowhere else to go, that, you know, that we have the potential in ourselves to get to the highest point.
Yeah.
I think it's just something built into our genetic code as human beings. We want to get to the top, to the tallest place.
I would always be thinking, well, I'm up here, but by God, I got to get down.
Well, that's right. That's completely true. I remember the last piece of it is this ridge. It's like maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet wide. There's huge thousands of feet on both sides if you step left or right. And I was so nervous to go up that ridge, but I was, when I summited, then I thought to myself, okay, now I have to get down. And I was literally so nervous, I was almost paralyzed. I didn't know what we were going to do. And you're roped up, you know, so if you fall, you drag your teammates off the mountain.
I know, yeah.
And I said, guys, I just have to say, I'm really nervous about getting down. And he said, my friends surrounded me, and they all put their arms around me, and they said, we'll get down. Don't worry.
And so you did. I would be more comfortable going up it than I would going down.
Yeah, 100%. It's easier going up in terms of the danger factor. Not even for sighted people, 9 out of 10 climbing accidents happen on the way down, because if you fall on the way down, you pitch down the mountain. You cartwheel down the mountain.
Yeah.
If you fall going up, you might fall into the slope, which isn't a big deal.
And so you had these poles that this guy had showed you or had sold you extended to 6 feet.
Yeah, I had them really long because I had to lean over and feel the really steep, you know, snow and ice below me, so that I'm going to step down onto.
Oh, man, it's you know, what the guy said the other day, was Eric's not here, and they said, no, he's out ice climbing, and I thought, sure, I'm glad it's him and not me, you know. But anyway, that done, you'd climb Mount McKinley, that done, there was, what was next?
We thought we'd have some other, we wanted another adventure, so the next summer, the AFB sponsored us to go climb El Capitan, which is a 3,000-foot rock face in Yosemite. It's a big overhanging granite rock face. It's kind of the pinnacle of rock climbing in America.
Uh-huh.
And we went and climbed that. We found this guy, Hans Florin, who's an amazing climber. He climbed El Cap, you know, 20 times or something. And that was our adventure. We trained all summer in Yosemite, and in August we climbed El Capitan. And then I just kept climbing from there. I went and climbed Kilimanjaro, which is an easier mountain in Africa, and got married to Ellen, my wife. We actually got married halfway up the peak.
You say it's an easier mountain?
Yeah, it's imagine hiking up a steep, you know, relatively steep slope, but a lot of it's dirt and rock and scree, and there's only snow and ice when you get up to the very top, so you don't need crampons or an ice axe or anything like that. They call it a non-technical mountain, but it is 19,300 feet.
Yeah, which was the highest you'd ever been.
Well, McKinley was higher by 1,000 feet.
Okay, all right.
And then I did the next year. That winter, you know, I thought, well, I can't teach and keep climbing, because some of the mountains I want to climb, I have to climb in the winter, and that's not fair to my students to take a month off. So I quit teaching.
All right.
And I thought I could make a living as a climber with some sponsorships and so forth. And it was a big risk. I was in Phoenix. I wanted to move to Colorado to get closer to the mountains. This guy Jeff, who I'd climbed McKinley with and El Capitan with, lived in Colorado. He said, "Move out, and we'll train together." And so I asked Ellen if she'd move out with me to Colorado, and she said, "Only if we're married." So he got married.
Down
Kilimanjaro, actually, as I said.
That's amazing.
Moved out to Colorado that next year, but and then I climbed Aconcagua, the tallest peak in South America, with Jeff and a couple other guys. This guy Chris Morris, who was our guide on McKinley, as well. And
it is how tall?
It is 23,000 feet, so it's 3,000 feet taller than McKinley.
Yeah.
We failed the first time. We had just terrible weather, and
that'd be awful.
One day of sun out of 18 days, so we just kind of just got beat up by the wind and by the cold, and actually got to 21,000 feet and had to turn back.
Good Lord! That's horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, it was rough because you work so hard to get there, and you spend money to get there, and then you get turned back. You get beaten back by the wind, and you realize that you could have done things differently and been more aggressive and so forth in certain ways. And so, you know, I went back the next year and summited with Chris, just one guy. Nobody else would go with me.
At that height, do you have no communication with anyone except the people that are with you, or do you have some radio communication with the ground?
Some mountains you might have a radio. On Everest, you have a radio that you can talk to even base camp with from the summit. But on Aconcagua, no, we didn't have any radios or anything. It was just me and Chris. And so that's one of the things he was really worried about, you know. He's like, you know, it's just us, so we can't make a mistake.
Really?
Here.
So you and your friend Chris climbed this 23,000-foot mountain peak by yourself.
Yeah, he walked in front of me, and we discovered that what went well with the pulls was when my friend in front of me would walk with a bell. He'd hang it from the loop of his ski pole, this kind of like a bear bell,
uh-huh.
And it would jingle. And I could hear him walking. I didn't have to focus so hard on his footsteps, on the sound. I could hear that bell jingling. But as it turned out, when we got up high, the bell just the wind hits it and blows snow into the bell, and it freezes, and you can't hear the bell anymore. So, and the winds we were about 60-mile-an-hour wind, so I couldn't hear Chris's footsteps either as we got up high. And so Chris that day would turn around every few minutes, and he would put his fingers in his mouth, and he would whistle at the top of his lungs, and I would go, "Oh, there he is," and I'd follow him, and then I'd hear him whistle again, and it was like the sort of session of Marco Polo on the mountain.
It's amazing. We're getting down close to the end now. Your biggest accomplishment, of course, was climbing Mount Everest. How many people were in that party? Tell us briefly about that.
We had 13 people, and 13 Westerners, and then we had 8 Sherpas, so altogether we were 21.
Uh-huh.
We're a big team, which is you need a big team on Everest because the attrition rate's so high. People drop out and get sick and get hurt.
And the Sherpa said, "Blind guy, no, that's no go. No, he can't do it. No.
The
get
Sherpas,
out of here."
The Sherpas were really, they're superstitious people, so they were really worried at first, you know, about a blind man. And blind people in their culture, you know, that don't do very much, you know.
No.
But one of them, as I said, this always happens, one of them signed on. He was a guy who had summited Everest twice. He was one of the Sherpas, and he said, "I'll take the chance." And all the other Sherpas said, "Well, if he's doing it, I'll do it too."
Because he's done it. He's summited twice. He knows what the hell he's doing.
Exactly.
I love it.
It always takes that one guy, you know. And so they all signed on, and we had a good team. And I invited all these friends back who had climbed with me over the years who had, you know, put my life in their hands, and they put their life in my hands, and I brought them all together onto one big team. And we got sponsorship.
Oh, you put the team together.
Yeah. I also had a team leader, though, that had summited in 98. His name was Pasquale Scaturo, and he was an amazing logistical person. He did all our logistics, and he actually invited 5 of the people on to the team that were his friends that had been to Everest and been to big Himalayan peaks before. And then I invited 5 or 6 of my friends who knew me, you know. And so our team were sort of Himalayan people with experience, and then people who knew me.
And you've got to mesh all those personalities together and make sure that everybody, of course, I guess in this instance, everybody's after one thing, so there's no petty BS going on there, not much.
You know, but we had a really good team as well because they were all friends. You know, as it turned out, we all climbed together for a couple of years and climbed together as an entity. And people were really behind me. You know, they wanted to get me to the summit. I mean, it wasn't just climbing Everest because that had been done before. But getting a blind guy to the summit was sort of like getting, you know, the first American to the moon. You know, it was they knew they were part of something pioneering and that this would be an historic climb. And so those guys were... for me, 100%, you know, and it was amazing because, you know, people said a blind person had no business on Everest and that I'd kill myself, I'd kill my team, you know, that, you know, we were going to have this huge disaster. And as it turned out, we got 19 of our teammates to the summit, which is a world record. No, we were we had the most people from one team to reach the summit, in a single day, and it's still
now,
a world record.
We're getting down short on time. How much of this, I guess all this is in the book, right?
All of this is in the book, yeah.
Has the book been read for blind people yet?
Yeah, we really made sure it's accessible. It's obviously in hardcover and in paperback,
yeah.
But it's in, you know, in bookstores. It's also commercially, it's on tape, it's on cassette tape and on CD. That's found at bookstores as well, but it's also in the talking books. It's also in recordings for the blind and dyslexic.
What is
in the National Braille Press? It's in Braille.
What is the name of the book?
It's called Touch the Top of the World, and probably the best way to do this is if you want to. We have an award-winning Everest documentary as well, called Farther Than the Eye Can See. And the best thing is to probably go to my website, touchthetop.com, and get that.
Touchthetop.com. Can you order the book in various forms there?
We'll send you. I just send you to Amazon because, you know, I don't really. I have a link to Amazon.
But the Library for the Blind for the Physically Handicapped has it. You can order it.
Yeah, they have it. Except the problem is that after I finished the book and I went to Everest and then I came home and the publisher said, you got to add a chapter on Everest in the book. So I added a new chapter and that's never been recorded by RFB and by Talking Books. So maybe I got to get on them and make them record the last chapter.
I think you certainly do. But now what about, do you know about Audible.com? Do you know about them? I guess they'd have the book, surely.
They probably have it as well.
I'm sure
and
they would.
Also, it's, I think, a publishing company called Wheeler Publications also has it in large print. So,
the name of the book is Touch the Top of the World, and it talks about your life, I guess. It talks about the same things we've talked about, right?
It's really a book about adventure, about loss, about gain, about friendship. It's about... I guess it's an inspiring book, but it's not inspiring in the traditional sense of the word because I wasn't trying to be some cheesy, heroic blind guy.
I understand.
I was writing honestly about my fear and my doubts about life and about climbing and pushing through that fear and that doubt and trying to make your life into something extraordinary.
You certainly are a busy man, and we're going to let you get back to your life. Our guest has been Eric Weinmayer. Eric, thank you, sir, very much. And I haven't read the book, but I'm looking forward to it.
Please do. Okay, good. Enjoy it.